The Word of Mouth Daily Podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock,
creating a new model for healthcare
where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system
improving the health of our communities
for years to come.
Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And
Doucette Survey,
serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England,
now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine.
Information at DOUCETSurvey.com. That's DoucetteSurvey.com.
And
Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money
through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto,
home, and personal loans.
Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at NECU.org.
Federally insured by NCUA.
Equal housing opportunity.
Word of mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Twitter is bigger than ever, no longer a media echo chamber. Looking back over the year's biggest Twitter stories, we get reminded that elections in India and Brazil and protesters in China and the Bring Back Our Girls campaign provide a glimpse of what the world is talking about outside of our little worlds and our little obsessions. Twitter feeds are now incorporated into news stories and voting referenda, into activism, into memorials, and of course, the Ice Bucket Challenge. Brady Carlson is here with us. He's host of All Things Considered at NHPR, and he is an avid Twitter follower who everybody should be following. Brady, great to have you back.
Thank you. I like to think of myself as not only a Twitter follower, but a leader of Twitter followers.
Good to know. Well, Brady, you got to sell me on Twitter. I mean, I have to say, I find it much harder, much more overwhelming to sort of break into the Twitter sphere than I do on Facebook.
I think, as you said at the beginning, it's so almost institutionalized now. Every news organization has it. Every public figure, politicians, comedians, TV shows, writers, everybody's on Twitter to at least to some degree. They have a presence there. And while that's cool in a way, it means that you're not going to have a shortage of people or organizations that you might want to follow and keep in touch with. I think it does make it tougher to find those nuggets of creativity, those really unusual serendipitous moments that used to be so much more prevalent on Twitter.
Well, for me, Facebook has become this medium where I can actually follow people and know about their lives, which I think is important, and they can know about mine. I mean, I had a really tough year. My dad passed away last month, and a lot of people following me on Facebook knew that. I would run into them. They would know what was happening. I don't feel like I have any instinct for what's going on in my personal life, especially on Twitter, because I won't get the responses. So, of course, it's all about the responses on some level.
The dynamic is different, and a lot of that is just the interface. When you go on Facebook, you're presented with what your friends are doing, and it's much more about having the relationships that are very distinct to you and very close to you. Twitter is more about being a droplet in a larger river, or an ocean even, of information and ideas. It is a place where I find more often than on Facebook or other social media sites that I will find something that is going to be bubbling up, not to overdo the water metaphor, but it's where I'm going to find instantaneous information. It's where I'm going to find sort of the latest ideas that people are going to be talking about. And then oftentimes I'll see a tweet containing a link to a big idea or a news story. And then a couple of days later, I'll start to see the discussions filtering out on Facebook about that same idea or that same story. Mm-hmm. So it's a not as intimate as perhaps, say, Facebook, but it's intended to have this more immediate effect on people and users.
So given that I'm going to ask you about who to follow on Twitter and those accounts may be followable for no more than the next 5 minutes because Twitter moves so quickly, how did you decide on which Twitter feeds to recommend?
Well, what I was aiming for was to try and find things that are not obvious. So I tried to come up with Twitter accounts that would introduce people to new ideas. I also want to provide a caveat that these are not comprehensive by any means. Twitter is a global thing, and there's so many interesting accounts that are going on in other parts of the world that it would take us months and months to try and do a comprehensive job of introducing people to all of those.
Okay, so with those criteria, established. Let's start with some that have actual news value, let's say in the traditional sense.
Well, I tried to come up with ones that had good context around them, somebody who might fill you in on some of the background. There's a historian who mostly focuses on presidential history, but he talks about all facets of American and world history. It's Michael Beschloss. He's written a number of books. But on Twitter, he's become quite adept at finding the historical artifact, the photo, the item that has something to do with the news of the day. So when the news broke about Cuba and the U.S., he found a photo of Vice President Nixon and Fidel Castro in the day, back in the Cold War, and just providing one of those moments. Anytime there's a news story going on, it's not simply just an on this day in history kind of feed, which is what's interesting. I've often heard it said that history is the story of the present told through the past, and his feed really exemplifies that. And you see the effect on that in institutions, museums, historical curators are all trying to do that now, what Michael Beschloss has been doing for some time.
That's Michael Beschloss's Twitter feed. We're going to post the entire list. I don't know if we're going to get to all of them today, Brady, but we will have those posted, the entire list posted at wordofmouthradio.org. Any others for real news or, you know, stuff that makes you really think?
I want to recommend a former colleague of mine. He now works at public radio in Boston, but our former colleague, Will Roselip, as far as I can tell, I'm no expert, but he is the most interesting voice in classical music that I've seen yet.
And here's really? I knew he was a cellist. I had no idea.
Here's what I mean by that. He is convinced that the biggest problem in classical music today is the way that we discuss classical music, that it's sort of shunted off into concert halls and presented as this very difficult thing to approach. And he's made the point that our frame of reference for classical music is way off. When you think about so many of the viral videos that we've seen over the years, you know, you've seen the group of cellists who, you know, will put that spontaneous concert together in the town square, or the violinist Joshua Bell showing up in the subway station and anonymously playing for people. There are these classical music videos who show up everywhere, even the videos of that group Two Cellos, the mm-hmm. two guys who play AC/DC songs through cellos with distortion pedals and fireworks and things in their concerts. There's a pop culture element of classical music, he's saying, that we are completely overlooking because we think it's stuck over in the concert hall. And he's saying all we have to do is start thinking about it in a different way and we'll start exploring this music again. Because classical music, as he puts it, used to be the music of the people. It was the folk music of its time.
It sounds quite sincere. He's on a bit of a mission. How about all of the sort of funny and phony and fakish people tweets that we see online? Any in that category come up?
There are so many. A couple worth recommending. There's one called Upworthy Spoiler. We've talked about Upworthy, the clickbait site, as it's derided as, or Upworthy will give you those headlines like, that ton of food your schools throw away? How about doing this instead? And they want you to click on it and share it with a million people. Upworthy Spoiler is a Twitter account that spoils what the clickbait headline is withholding from you. So for that ton of food your schools throw away, how about do this instead? Upworthy Spoiler posted, donate it to soup kitchens, because that's what you'd find if you went and clicked on the article. So they go through these pieces and find the answer to the clickbait question.
You don't even need to click through.
That's right. And what happened after I checked out that Twitter feed changed everything.
Brady Carlson is with us, who keeps a keen eye on the social media and news media universe. We're talking about some of his picks for those to follow on Twitter. There was one that you shared with me recently, TV Network Notes, which showed an almost prescient kind of way of communicating now that we've seen all those leaked Sony emails. What was this?
They were really ahead of the game on this one. These are purported to be actual notes from network executives to TV show producers and creators that are beyond the pale. For example, the cable channel True TV said, quote, this show needs to make sense to someone who just looked up from taking a bong hit. That was apparently the note they gave to a producer of a show. There's one that the people who created The Walking Dead on AMC said, they had pitched the show to NBC before ending up on cable, and they were told, apparently, this is awesome. I really love it. Does it have to have zombies in it?
So the phony Sony, I guess, on some level, TV network notes. Another that you shared with me previously was TLDR Wikipedia. Now, what's that? Too long didn't read.
Too long didn't read, right? That's a long time acronym on the web. But TLDR Wikipedia is essentially like a one sentence version of what you might find in a Wikipedia article. But of course, they are all pretty clever ways of summarizing the pieces. So, for example, there's a font is a style of typeface carefully chosen to make your English teacher think a paper is 5 pages long.
I really liked male pattern baldness is a condition which, if left untreated, eventually results in a new Corvette.
Or there's this one here in public broadcasting. This might hurt a little bit, but it says, Ken Burns is what happens when a PowerPoint gets funding from the Kellogg Foundation and viewers like you.
Okay, and then, of course, there is the personality-driven Twitter feed. Now, you didn't give us Taylor Swift or Beyonce. What have you got?
There are a couple of different personalities. I tried to find people who I thought were going to say things that were going to be a little bit outside the norm so that you would get a different perspective. For example, there's a writer named Casey Johnston who writes about tech, and she writes about feminist issues in tech, which has been a big issue, especially this year with Gamergate and some of the other issues that have come up. She wrote a piece about how tech diversity has been affected by the decline in AP computer classes in high school, so that if you're not having people get involved in these things at an early age, then you start to see that later on down the road in higher education and then in the workforce. She started getting these tweets back from men not realizing that she had written the article. So they would say things like, you know, you need to read this whole article to really understand what's going on. And she would write back in these very effective Twitter burns, I wrote the article. So she's a voice I think that we hopefully will hear a lot more of in the coming year. Another one is, his name is Michael Twitty, but he's best known for having, he has a fantastic Twitter handle. Kosher Soul is his Twitter handle. His blog is known as Afro Culinaria. He is a culinary historian. He studies the history of food, in particular the history of food talking about enslaved people. And he has a perspective that is just fascinating when you talk about some of the issues that have come up in the news this year about something like Ferguson or Eric Garner in New York. He can take a broad approach rather than people sort of reacting just to the minute of what's going on at that very moment. Taking a look at the issue of race in America, which is as elemental a question as you can get in American history, and taking a look at what 300 or 350 years of these conversations look like and how it might apply to today. And he does it through the lens of food, which is genius. I mean, one, he knows his stuff. He's a very interesting cook, and he goes for the absolute most authentic way of cooking dishes that are several hundred years old, the same utensils, the same exact types of vegetables and meats and so forth. He also gives people a way in who might be uncomfortable talking about it through the usual channels of criminal justice or politics or the economy. He's able to take it through food, and food is a thing we all have in common. We can all get into some complex issues when we talk through food, which is fascinating.
Brady, I'm thinking, you know, what about people who aren't on Twitter when they hear all this? I mean, you don't need to actually be on Twitter to follow these feeds. That's one thing we should make very clear. People can go and look at them. But who are you following on Facebook?
Well, right now, I would recommend, this is actually nice because it's local, I would recommend the Mount Washington Observatory. They post, obviously, weather data and information like that, but their photographs are fantastic. And Facebook has become increasingly visual over the last couple of years. They've made photos a lot larger. They used to be tiny. And now they're a huge part of the screen real estate when you visit Facebook, whether that's on your mobile device or whether it's just on the plain web browser. And they look great. The information is great. They're very shareable. And they're just very fun. They're clearly very enthusiastic about what they do for a living. And it's something that you can enjoy even in the coldest day of the coldest part of the year, which is clearly what we're headed toward in the immediate future.
Well, Brady, thank you so much for making me a little bit more excited about Twitter. I'm going to go back to your water metaphor and think of a Chinese proverb that I once heard. Oh, little drop, give yourself up and gain the ocean. Is that a way to get to Twitter?
It is. And it's very tweetable, too. That's not even 140 characters.
Brady, what's your Twitter handle?
At Brady Carlson.
Brady Carlson. He is NHPR's All Things Considered host. We'll have Brady's full list of Twitter feeds to follow at wordofmouthradio.org. Coming up, we're going to step back in time to the golden age of radio and discover the origins of Irving Berlin's classic White Christmas and why it sounds so darn melancholy. That's when Word of Mouth continues after a short break.
Christmas, just like the ones I used to know.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. There are several types of songs within the genre of holiday music. There are the traditional hymns, goofy kids songs sung by chipmunks, and upbeat pop versions by Billboard top artists. And then there is White Christmas. Producer Katie Sewell from the Radio Retrospective brings us the story behind the Irving Berlin classic.
The holiday season is upon us, and so are the Christmas carols. No doubt you're hearing them in every store you enter. But there is one song that stands apart from the others. It's not upbeat, it's not about fanciful characters, and it isn't religious. It's melancholy, it's wistful, and it's full of longing for bygone days.
I'm dreaming of a white Christmas, just like the ones I used to know.
White Christmas was written by Irving Berlin, the same songwriter who composed Alexander's Ragtime Band and God Bless America. And people heard White Christmas for the first time ever on a radio show sponsored by the Kraft Company. It was Christmas Day, 1941.
Kraft Music Hall with Bing Crosby, Mary Martin, Victor Borge, Jerry Lester, John Scott Trotter and his orchestra, and the Music Maids and Hal. And here's Bing Crosby.
I like New York in June. How about you?
Bing Crosby and the Kraft Music Hall was a show that mainly appealed to young people. The average listener age was 21. So it's possible that the younger generation embraced White Christmas first. But the longing and coziness of the song had a deeper meaning that day. Families tuning into the Christmas broadcast were thinking about the tragic event that happened just 18 days before.
We interrupt this broadcast to bring you this important bulletin from the United Press. Flash, Washington. The White House announces Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor.
The following year, in the winter of 1942, young American troops found themselves overseas during the holidays. An armed forces radio played White Christmas over and over to remind them of home. It's been a permanent part of the Christmas holiday ever since. Bing Crosby recorded the song for distribution in 1942. In an interview, he talked about traveling overseas to perform for the troops.
The song that is most asked for from me over there was White Christmas. Really got so that I hesitated about doing it because invariably it caused such a nostalgic yearning among the men that made them sad. And heaven knows I didn't come that far to make them sad. And for this reason, several times I tried to cut it out of the show, but these guys just hollered for it.
By the end of the war, White Christmas was the best-selling song of all time. It held that distinction for 56 years. That is, until 1997, when Princess Diana died.
Your candles burned out long before your legend ever will.
Elton John's remake of Candle in the Wind was the first song to really challenge the popularity of White Christmas. But White Christmas is still a part of the holidays. And once you're a part of the holidays, you're in. And it may surprise you to know that unless you were alive in the 1940s, you've never heard the recording of White Christmas that made it famous. The radio premiere of the song on Kraft Music Hall was lost, or taped over, and Bing Crosby's original 1942 master recording, the version heard by the troops overseas, wore out from overuse. The most familiar version is from 1947, when Bing re-recorded the song, hoping to recapture the original magic. For composer Irving Berlin, White Christmas was an unexpected hit. It was a simple song, just 54 words and 67 notes. It was written for a musical review about the holidays, a failed project that eventually became the movie Holiday Inn. Irving Berlin thought a different song from that film would become popular. Here he is.
I had a song in there called Be Careful, It's My Heart, for Valentine's Day. That's the song I picked as the big hit, and it was a fair success. But I also had a song in there called White Christmas.
And that song won him an Academy Award, and is still the best-selling Christmas song of all time. Which is interesting, given the fact that Irving Berlin didn't even celebrate Christmas. He was a Jewish man who immigrated from Russia as a child. And Christmas was a very sad and solemn day for him. While many American families opened gifts around the Christmas tree, Irving Berlin had his own tradition. Every year, he visited the grave of his son, Irving Berlin Jr., who died on Christmas Day, 1928, at only 3 weeks old. Perhaps it is this truly human melancholy that gives White Christmas staying power. 72 years after it first appeared on the radio, you're still likely to turn it up rather than off.
May your day be merry and bright, and may all your be white.
I'm Katie Sewell.
All right, we're going to continue with the warm holiday glow. Up next, a pro wrestler abandons the ring for Santa's sleigh. We'll hear that story when word of mouth continues.
Chestnuts roasting on an open fire. Jack Frost nipping at your nose.
Word of
mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of
mouth.
Who's got a beard that's long and white?
Santa's got a beard that's long and white.
Who comes round on special night?
Santa comes round on special night.
Special night.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. This time of year, they're everywhere, sitting for photos at the mall or ringing jingle bells outside of the grocery store. I'm speaking, of course, about Santas. While they may appear to be an indistinguishable mass of red velvet suits, rosy cheeks, and fake white beards, we wanted to take a closer look. Sean Hurley brings us the story of a surprisingly familiar Saint Nick.
Below a half moon, on a snowbound night, high on a hill in the town of Littleton, an unexpectedly large man with an overturned bucket of tangled hair stepped into the lobby of the Hampton Inn.
He was this, like, big, burly, strong guy.
For the hotel's night manager, Kristen Burkholder, it was hard to tell whether it was a damaged hip or knee that made the man's limp so pronounced. Burkholder noticed that the man's two front teeth were missing, that part of his right ear was gone.
He said that he travels with a Santa Claus costume, and if we wanted him to, he'd be happy to hang out in the lobby for an hour and read stories to the kids.
There wasn't any time to make an announcement or put up signs, and Burkholder still isn't sure why. She finally agreed to let the strange man sit in her hotel lobby.
I'm kind of thinking, oh my gosh, Santa's about to show up and this may backfire.
The man disappeared. He dressed in crimson robes and coal black boots. He tucked his wild hair into his Santa wig and drew the white hair down to cover his damaged ear and fixed a plate into his mouth so that Santa would have two front teeth. Red cap in place, he slung a bag full of toys over his shoulder and limped into the lobby.
But he sat down, and all of a sudden, within minutes, there was a line of kids just, you know, patiently waiting to sit on his lap and tell him what they want for Christmas.
Come on over here. Would you like to climb up here?
There you go. Yeah.
Are you looking forward to Christmas?
Yeah, and I saw Johnny.
You saw Johnny?
The owl.
Oh, where did you run into Johnny?
He went in our wreath.
Oh, he went in your wreath, though. That's a good place for an elf, right?
Yeah. He was so great. He was so, like, he was such a nice guy, super interactive, very patient, very friendly.
None of the children and none of their parents knew who the man in the red suit was. That once upon a time, he'd been a kind of nightmare to kids all over the world. But by the time the line had cleared, one of the hotel staff had figured out Santa's real identity.
I have to get your autograph because my daughter's a wrestler.
Santa puts a shushing, secret finger to his lips.
Sorry, she was a wrestler, and she would love...
What's her name?
Carrie.
How do you spell that?
C-A-R-R-I-E. She would love it.
Weighing 287 pounds, Mankind!
He was born Mick Foley on Long Island, New York. His manifestations as Dude Love and Cactus Jack are infamous, but none are more deranged than Mankind.
It was 1996 when Mick Foley belted a Hannibal Lecter mask over his face and stepped into the ring as Mankind, one of the darkest, most unhinged, most controversial, and most successful characters in professional wrestling history. The same year Mankind was born, 1996, Mick Foley visited Santa's Village in Jefferson, New Hampshire.
I was probably 16 or 17 when Mick first came to the park.
Christian Gaynor runs Santa's Village with his sister and brother-in-law. A third-generation owner, Gaynor's grandparents opened the park in 1953, and he grew up here.
You know, he was a WWE superstar. He was the guy on TV. I didn't approach him at all. I was like half a dozen other employees, and we're just kind of following around, seeing what he did. And from place to place, all of our employees would get excited and ask him questions about wrestling and wrestling Hulk Hogan and all the other big names of the WWE. But as his day kept on going, he kept on getting more inspired by the park and by the enthusiasm of our employees, and it just created a buzz for everybody, and there's been no turning back since.
I think I was able to explore that darker side. Because I had the yearly visits to this place. I honestly feel like that helped me cope, that I could really be convincing in my bad guy mannerisms, because I had a really nice counterbalance in the, you know, in the joy of Christmas.
Every year he's here unannounced, he shows up, he's part of the family. We welcome him with open arms and his whole family.
As a matter of fact, it was on that roller coaster there, climbing the peak, that my daughter, who in 1998 would have been 4, kissed me on the cheek. And when I asked her what that kiss was for, she said, "Because you're a good man." And slightly more than 24 hours later, I was thrown off a massive steel structure by The Undertaker. And so after all these years, one of the great questions I have is, what in the world was I doing at Santa's Village the day before the biggest match of my career?
Not only the biggest match in his career, Hell in a Cell is considered one of the great events in WWE history, and saw Mankind being thrown not once, but twice from a height of 16 feet. The first fall was highly planned and well practiced, but the second, which knocked him unconscious, was an accident. The injuries he sustained during Hell in a Cell hastened the end of his formal wrestling career in 2000.
But yeah, I just remember that. Going up there, kissing me on the cheek, telling me I was a good man.
Does that create any kind of conflict for you when you think about those two things together?
I don't. Not a conflict. I mean, it's a great paradox. Yeah. But I learned to live with it.
In 1999, during an autograph session, Foley got the sense that his days as mankind were coming to an end, and that another character, maybe his last, was preparing to emerge.
And off in the distance, about halfway through this massive line, I saw this little boy with the telltale scars of many, many surgeries for severe burns.
Foley called the boy up to the front of the line.
But it was then that his mother told me that Antonio had needed to wear a mask during the process of his healing. At the time, he was 3, and like most 3-year-olds, wanted nothing to do with the wearing of a mask, until his mother told him that his favorite wrestler, Mankind, wore a mask. And it kind of filled me with this sense of joy. It was almost like I could feel my conscience calling out to me. And so I asked his mom if he could sit on my lap while I took care of the rest of the people in line. And people were visibly moved. Like, there were people wiping away tears. And as he walked away, I got this distinct feeling that I knew what it was like to be Santa Claus. And a distinct feeling that, that this was something I would like to experience again.
And so he did. After visiting Sierra Leone in 2008, Foley funded construction of a large primary school there, which was completed in 2009. In 2011 alone, as a volunteer for the Rape, Abuse, and Incest National Network, Foley logged more than 550 hours talking to victims. Following Hurricane Sandy, Foley gave his dining room furniture to a Long Island family who'd lost theirs in the storm. He then promptly invited himself over for dinner, so he could eat at his old table one last time. In 2012, it became official.
I have an official ambassador's letter that proclaims me an official ambassador, so that anytime I put on the red suit, I am officially known as Santa Mick.
Foley was inducted into the WWE Hall of Fame in 2013. He knew exactly how he wanted to go out, exactly how he wanted to leave his fans.
I tried to talk Mr. McMahon into allowing me to exit Madison Square Garden on a sleigh flying into the sky. And I knew he had the capability of making it happen. He just didn't understand why it was so important to me.
And so, below a half moon, on a snowbound night, high on a hill in the town of Littleton, an unexpectedly large man with an overturned bucket of tangled hair stepped into the lobby of the Hampton Inn.
And you, young man, what would you like for Christmas?
Maroon catching gear.
Maroon catching gear. I can do that.
None of the children and none of their parents knew who the man in the red suit was. They called him Santa, and they knew inside him lay all the goodness and all the care and all the mystery and hope. Inside him, the single, simple majesty we believe exists in the very heart of all of mankind. For word of mouth, and yes, Virginia, there is a Mick Foley. This is Sean Hurley.
Holidays are here, time for family gatherings and perhaps some awkward conversations. Up next, we're going to tackle the art of conversation and share some tips on how to get a good one started with anyone, anywhere. That's when Word of Mouth returns after a short break. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Does this scenario sound familiar? You're at a holiday gathering and somehow end up with a plate in your lap and a friend of a friend sitting next to you. You scan your mind for something to say and come up with bubkis. Don't fret, don't stammer, and don't get irritable. Help is on the way. In their book, What to Talk About, Chris Collin and Rob Baedeker offer tips on how to start a good conversation with anyone, anywhere. They joined me this spring when their book was first published. Chris and Rob, thanks so much for being with us.
Hi, Virginia. Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
I was wondering which one of you was going to talk first.
That's a big problem, isn't it, in conversation, especially when you have more than two people.
On the radio.
That, yeah, awkward stall. So you've got to come prepared to put a foot forward and to offer something.
Well, we believe in breaking the don't talk about money rule. We believe in breaking almost every rule because saying the right thing is too much pressure. Saying the wrong thing is often far more interesting, and that's the point of conversation. We're trying to be interesting and memorable. Life is short. You got to talk a little more boldly.
Almost every rule? Are there any things that are just taboo you won't even touch?
We're just going to wait and see if you do that, and then we'll let you know if you said something horribly offensive.
Well, let's make it clear. You are not scientists. You're not motivational speakers, but you're academics. So who's your audience for this book?
Our audience, well, at first it was ourselves, and then it sort of became everyone when we realized that a lot of people shared our problem. We found that we were sort of panicking all the time, really. I mean, we're relatively smart people, especially me. And yet, you know, you find yourself in an elevator or on the seat next to someone on a plane, and you sort of panic over what to say. Or you have a really close friendship or a romantic relationship. You've been together or been friends for many years, and your conversations are sort of middling.
Everywhere we go, people, when they hear about the book, say, I need that. And they're good talkers. I mean, we're doing fine, but there's about a 10% gap. Or 11%, because we are actually scientists and inventors and motivational speakers and now authors. And people want to get better. They want to bridge the gap about 10% of the time to go further, make it more interesting, make it more fun.
So you guys are really good at filling in those awkward pauses with some conversation starters or cold openings, as you call them. My favorite might have been, I bet your spirit animal is an attic raccoon. Sure to get a...
Virginia, that's your spirit animal, isn't it?
How did you know?
There's something, I think, in the voice. We're very intuitive. And
being intuitive is part of being a good talker. You've got to relax. Sometimes you have to close your eyes in a conversation, tune into your instincts.
And you're very resourceful, obviously. We just met you. But an attic raccoon has figured some stuff out, how to find a warm house. You know, this is a compliment.
Well, thank you very much, because I'm not sure if I feel complimented. But what are some of the other kind of cold openings that you guys have come up with?
Well, often we need conversation in these sort of glancing exchanges with the person at the cash register in the checkout lane at the grocery store. You know, Rob, what would you say to that person when you don't just want to say hi? How's it going?
I'd say those shoes are incredible. Where did you get them? I would say, you know, offer a dilemma to people. This gets the mind going in a different way. I would say if you had a third eye in the middle of your back and you were online dating, would you mention it in your profile or would you wait for the first date? It really lets people open up.
Yeah. Does anybody look at you when you say something like that to them and maybe think, I don't think I want to talk to this person?
If that happens, you're doing something right. No, but in all seriousness, you know, we think it's okay to sort of go into weird territory every now and then. You don't want to be totally weird and have no friends. But in our experience, people are open to all sorts of things, far more than we think when we walk into a conversation. People want to go into left field every now and then because, you know, deep inside we're all weird.
People do say, though, that they dislike small talk. You know, it's superficial, it's party talk. But they seem to do plenty of it. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, small talk is a great starting place. We don't dismiss small talk, but you got to make it bigger. You got to push further. So the classic small talk subject is the weather, right?
Right.
And how's the weather? It's cold. It's hot. Pretty finite category. But push that into big talk by asking a weather-related question. For example, what's the coldest you've ever been? Or what's the worst sunburn you've ever had? You take the weather and you push it into the realm of story. And now we're getting somewhere.
I guess that's sort of like approaching a good interview. You know, you don't want to ask people a yes or no question. You want to make them tell a story.
Right. Yeah, curiosity is key, right? And also admitting your own ignorance. Too often we're worried about looking smart or letting on that we don't know something. But if you can put your heads together with somebody, there's ignorance is fun. In other words, you can explore the question of what is wind? What is thunder? Speaking of weather-related topics, I kind of know, but I'm not totally sure. And if I pair up with a good conversation partner, we can have fun exploring that.
What exactly was the Korean War about? Could I really describe the difference between a democracy and a republic? You know, if you sort of expose your ignorance, we find that that's a great way to connect with people because then they can expose theirs and then you can sort of bond over how stupid you are. And that's sort of a sweet feeling. It's poignant.
I'm speaking with Chris Collin and Rob Bedeker. They are co-authors of the book What to Talk About. This is for on a plane or at a cocktail party or in a tiny elevator with your boss's boss. What kind of things do you say? You're talking a little bit also about how we reflect each other, right? There's a segment in the book on mirroring that our mm-hmm. responses to small questions actually matter. So tell us about this mirroring phenomenon.
Well, mirroring is repeating blandly the same words or idea of the person you're talking to. We do it all the time, right? So it's a beautiful day. Yeah, it's a beautiful day. And the conversation just drops a transmission, so to speak, and all of its tires go flat.
There's also a lot of mirroring that happens just in the most common conversation starter and killer, which is, hi, how's it going? And we mirror by even indulging that question, fine, it's going fine. And Rob and I are big advocates of answering the question that you wish had been asked. How's it going? You know, I've been thinking about the Chuckwalla lizard, which is a real lizard that can live without water. And pretty soon you're talking about what it means to live without water, how the scientists even learned this, and you can start talking about something more interesting than how's it going.
Okay, so you guys are talking about a lot of interpersonal stuff, but how about a party? Now, this is the sort of the nadir for people who are fearful of coming up with the right conversation. How do you prepare?
Well, one thing we recommend is preparing. You know, I think people are a little allergic to the idea of coming to a social situation with some kind of canned answer. You might seem like a phony or something. I think
the preparing, you mean like, you know, sort of in the bathroom mirror before you go, preparing some small talk?
Any mirror, bathroom, bedroom, car mirror.
They make tiny mirrors now you can actually carry around in your pocket.
But anyways, no, we mean, you know, having something ready to go in case your mind goes white and you absolutely can't summon a thought. And then it's fine to say, hey, you know, this reminds me of something I've been thinking about.
You use the word nadir, Virginia, which is a great word. And if I had nothing else to talk about right now, I might ask you about that word, which is an example of what we call a trigger word, pulling something out of the other person's sentence and being curious about it or taking it in a new direction.
Well, I wondered if I should have said nadir, actually.
I wondered, too. You know, that's something to talk about. How confident were you when you said nadir? You know, I think we all sort of wonder about these kinds of things all the time. Did I say it wrong? Oh, my God.
Well, all right, I'm going to set the scene here. We're at a party, or you're at a party. You don't know that many people. Everybody seems to be insulated in impenetrable conversations. They're talking about nadirs or nadirs and fascinating things like that. So how do you break in?
Well, one thing that you can do is play a game. People like games. We're all children inside. Walk into a circle and say, okay, I'm just going to introduce myself. My name is so-and-so. Who would each of you be if you had to be cast in a movie? You know, who do we think we are? Are you the nabbishy accountant? Are you the sarcastic, wisecracking friend? Are you the swashbuckling hero? And pretty soon you're not, you know, it's a safe topic. Everyone knows about movies. It's funny. But you're sort of introducing yourselves.
Facebook and Twitter are often dismissed as party conversation, as superficial conversation. Is the nature of conversation changing since we have Facebook and Twitter? Because, you know, there are a lot of provocative things that are put out in social media.
I think that they are great. They're wonderful. Anytime you're having a nice time and sharing pictures of your kids, that's great. But I also think it's good to be mindful of the ways that they are sucking the thoughts out of our heads, even when we're not aware. I mean, think about the last time you were waiting for your hot dog to finish microwaving. What did you do? You took the phone out of your pocket and you Instagrammed. It used to be that we would have thoughts pop into our head, and the well of ideas would gradually replenish. And now we worry that that's not happening as much as it should.
On the other hand, you can hone your language, especially on Twitter, where brevity is a necessity. It allows you to sharpen your thoughts, and you can recycle those in the real world.
Well, good to know. Thank you for that helpful tip, and all the rest, Chris and Rob.
Thank you, Virginia.
Thanks, Virginia.
That is my earlier conversation with Chris Conlon and Ron Baedeker, co-authors of What to Talk About. And thank you so much for joining us today. If you like what you heard, there is much more at wordofmouthradio.org. We also invite you to send us your feedback or share your ideas for the program on Facebook and on Twitter. And as the year draws to a close, we hope you have a couple of days off coming to you. Well, we send you our best wishes for those and hope you get a chance to unwind and connect with family and friends and find some room for conversation and maybe even some quality time reflecting on the year that's been while we look forward to the next one. Happy, wonderful, joyful holidays to all of you from all of us at Word of Mouth. Right here at New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by
Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
and senior producer Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its board of trustees,
or its underwriters. Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.
We don't want to jinx our monopoly money. We only